Good morning,
evening,
and afternoon.
Welcome, my friends, to the Year of the Sandwich. Now today, we take a visit into a much spicier realm than usual, because sandwiches are truly an international feature, but not every sandwich is pure of purpose. You see, with how many ways we can combine our intentions and our ingredients, we find ourselves in a realm of what may be considered fusion cooking, right? Not fission cooking, which seems a lot hotter, but the fusion style, where you take two things that may, at times, mingle, and you force them together intimately. Now, there are actually examples of this around us, and from the area of the crust we are currently underneath, the Philadelphia area of the United States, they actually do have a couple of these fusion style foods. I wouldn't say they're all successes, necessarily, but one horrid experiment, no doubt, is called the Philadelphia Roll. And this, my friends, is a fusion type of sushi roll, or what I like to call a Japanese burrito. Although really, think about it for a minute, sushi is much older than burritos, actually. So really, I guess, potentially burritos could be known as a Mexican roll. But I digress, my friends. The Philadelphia Roll thing, it's a sushi roll, you know, seaweed, rice, and then cream cheese on the inside. Rather offensive choices, I believe. But there's a well-known brand called Philadelphia Cream Cheese. It's an American brand, you might expect. And they go with that to create what I would consider the strangest mouthfeel and texture you can imagine. However, they do perfect it with a cheesesteak egg roll, which is the right kind of fusion cooking. So, what does that mean for us today? Well, thankfully, my friends, we visit the land that used to be known as Indochina to sample a lovely, spicy concoction, otherwise known as banh mi, a Vietnamese hoagie. And to achieve the proper investigation into this fusion-style sandwich of much mystery at the moment, I've brought along a professional man, a man who has spent so many years behind a wok, you might think he is Chinese, but my friends, he is not. I do have, however, quite a personal relationship with him, and so I do trust his opinions. I imagine you might do the same. So let me welcome into the subterranean level of the Yacht's Headquarters America, one of my best mates, Kyleman. Thanks for joining me down here.
It's my pleasure. It's a little warm down here for my taste, but
the wok, right? It takes eons, really.
Ooh, stand in front of a wok hole. You want to talk warm.
Ah, it's true. And so you've been prepared, really, ever since we were working over these light woks.
Tempered, if you will.
It is a process. So really, banh mi is in central focus right now. And for those who may never have had this delicious sandwich, I will have Mr. Kyle actually introduce exactly what we sampled today so you can understand what we're talking about. The floor is yours.
If you could get the veggies and proteins out of your favorite kind of noodle dish that you would get at, for a simple analogy, a Chinese restaurant or like a Singapore street noodle, I feel like is a good base reference. Minus the curry undertones, well-marinated meats, very clean, fresh flavors from, you know, your herbs, a couple really crisp vegetables. And like I said, the primary flavor here is coming from the protein and the marinade. Everything else is very simple and it's just very true to its colors, textures, lots of textures. But instead of enjoying these textures over soft noodles and the starch coming in a, like, you know, a nice warm kind of vessel of that melds in, and the primary texture you're getting is the crisp carrots, the daikon. You can even, you know, the flavor of the cilantro is there. We put it into, as you so eloquently put, a Philadelphia roll, in the sense that you have a very crispy, very glutinous roll that just delivers this beautiful chew that just is, and inside of it now. So instead of enjoying these flavors melting into the starch is kind of, it's almost encompassed the flavors that we enjoy. So little things about the textures of the vegetables become the accompanying flavors to the roll, almost, in the sense that it's like a large dumpling or even, you know, you made the burrito reference. I would go as far to say almost a taco, in the sense that we have littered these ingredients inside of this vessel and it is open on the top. I mean, there's a whole conversation, I'm sure, at some point that will melt your mind grapes, so to speak, on the sandwich dichotomies of, you know, have you ever heard of the cube diagram? We'll have to get into that.
Oh, no, I've heard of this cube.
Oh, well, and this is another episode.
Sounds lovely. It does.
But you still enjoy the textures of these vegetables, but because of the chew to the sandwich, it's a very American vessel. I know I used the word vessel already, but it looks very American, although it does not taste American. It does not smell American.
I would say that is probably the least American portion of it. I mean, yeah, at first sight, submarine, what they call it up in the middle of this country, a grinder, something like that.
Heroes.
Hero.
No, not even the GY. We're not doing Greek. I'm talking about the yins over in the Berg. They do that hero thing.
Oh, the hero. So many names, but what we're really talking about is a torpedo-shaped roll.
Correct. And not overstuffed, like, you know, lovingly calling out Philadelphia cheesesteaks earlier, going back to that, you know, where you a delectable cheesesteak or quality cheesesteak will be overflowing with protein and cheese and other accoutrements, where this sandwich does not look overpacked or overfilled.
It's nicely tucked.
You look at it, you're like, oh, a sandwich. What kind of, am I looking at Italian meats today? Is this a, you know, just a nice dressed up ham and cheese? We're going to the deli. Is there pastrami on this corned beef? What do we got? Mm-hmm. But you bite in and you are instead taken away to another part of the planet entirely, where your brain has been looking at this roll and feeling this crispy, delicious, really profoundly good roll. And all of a sudden you're enjoying cilantro, carrots, daikon, marinated pork or chicken.
Little cucumber down the centrals.
Oh, and big old hunk of cucumber. The beautiful flavor of a jalapeno with just a little bit of the kick.
Fresh, my friends, fresh jalapeno. Fresh.
And I think that is one of the most important things when you talk about fusion, is highlighting the ingredients of the things that you're putting together, because you have to, the identities of the two things that come together have to still, you have to be able to identify them still, because you've lost the fusion if it becomes kind of its own. I don't think you're doing the word fusion justice, and you're not doing the food justice if you lose either or either.
I would agree. So the first part of this fusion is obviously, if you were doing a Japanese burrito, you could see the inside is from one and the outside is from the other sauce. And this is seemingly sort of the format for our fusion foods, because with at least banh mi, the outside is derived from a French baguette.
And the quality of the bread, I think, again, to highlight, is super important. And that is, if you ate this roll by itself, you wouldn't necessarily know what culture of food you were eating. You would just know the people who are passionate about their bread.
Yeah. And funny enough, this really relates back to the core of what is banh mi, because the word or the phrase banh mi, it actually existed well before the sandwich. It sort of came into the sandwich zone. Banh or ban actually means just a baked good or product in their language. And mi means wheat. So it literally means like wheat or roll or sandwich, as it became known. Now, this was, of course, an exchange in the early 19th century, French Indochina. So we're talking about old political lines, mates, back before things were divided up in the modern way. And so the French were occupying an area we know as Vietnam, and they passed along their baguette, right? Because if you've ever met a Frenchman, you know you can't really walk away without having some bread in your mouth. As a result, they started to adapt this sandwich. And by the 1950s, we ran into what is the first real standardization of the sandwich as a street food. As you'd imagine, a lot of these things, Singapore street noodles, you've already mentioned, it's street food, very quick and easy. And in that way, it makes you feel like on your feet. It's not the sort of thing to put you down and make you take an afternoon sabbatical. And so they generally made it in the French way back then. And I do not take it French, but I let you take it French today, my mate. Do you know what the French ingredient really is besides the bread in that? And you saw, I, of course, avoided it like the plague.
Oh, the...
It's a very French word as well.
White man's poison.
Ugh.
As
the unborn.
Another loving mate of mine once put it, mayonnaise.
It's true. Now, you've noticed from at least the other episode when we were able to get the guests down into the base layer here, that I always asked, you know, what's your favorite condiment? What's your least favorite? There's three questions beyond the dossier and background checks we perform on our guests. But I did not ask this man, as I told you, he's my best mate, and I already know that he hates peanut butter, and I already know the kinds of things that he will actually eat mustard like a foul mutant might. So I did not have to ask. He already knows what I consider poison, and that is the very French word mayonnaise. Let's just say we allow mayonnaise eaters into yachts as a result of a legal issue that we ran into when we tried to prevent their access, but we will do what we can until we cannot. And so mayonnaise and the bread were the contributions of the French people. So thus, much like the egg roll, they contributed on the outside layers and then the entire inside, as you mentioned, pickled daikon, carrots, a big old quarter cut of cucumber, as well as what is fresh cilantro, if I'm correct, always fresh. Although I do like cooked, it is a much different flavor.
Much more subtle.
I went with the beef. You were the pork, I believe, in this indeed. One, right? Now,
swine.
I don't think it matters which way you go, but the lovely thing on either of these situations is the bread gets flavored. Some of the runoff, and now we are anti-wet bread.
There are no soggy bottoms on this show, please.
Are you actually, he brought us a gift that survived through the mantle, some shortbread.
Indeed. Nice fingers of shortbread to satiate the appetite after such a grueling conversation, which is surely to drum up an appetite once again by the time we're finished.
I'll leave you with a bit because the journey back is so long, you will need some food, mate. However, if you've ever run into, and I haven't, but I would not eat wet shortbread.
That sounds disgusting.
It sounds foul, right? Wet bread is like an illegal thing, less it be in these small applications where you can have it kind of gravy itself. It's not that the bread's wet, but it has been marinated a bit.
With the protein and the sandwich, like especially with the mayonnaise in this application, it kind of marinates the flavors of the other ingredients to the bread. It's not, I wouldn't go as far to use the analogy of the glue that holds the sandwich together, because it's not a necessary ingredient for our friend here who does not enjoy mayonnaise, as I am learning proper pronunciations here. So you learn something new every day, even from your best mates, so to speak. And for me, not passionate about mayo. I don't really prefer it on most things, but it has its applications. And this is very much a sandwich where I would probably not, I would order it with, because
it's part of it, really.
It truly is. And
it's flavored mayo, technically.
It's flavored mayo, and I'm fairly certain it is house-made mayo.
And there's a dedication, and I give it to you as well, because I know you also experiment with some foods that are on the edge of my palatability, and that is, if it's ever made at home, I will try it. I have no right to be able to deny a true home cook, but if you're buying me a jar of some Hellman's god-awful Satan's piss, I will not, sir. I will not.
Served room temperature for you, friend.
My word, the smell. The pure smell of it. Now, speaking of smells, this is on a scale of 1 to barely able to take it in a closed vehicle. This is up there in the smell category.
The windows were cracked on the door.
Now, we had 3 in our shotgun, and what would you say is the closest smell? Feet?
Feet is fair. Small anecdote on the topic of the smell of these sandwiches. Mm-hmm. It was mentioned, you know, I have a background in some food. Another fellow on this show, there's only 2 of us here after all, spent a lot of time working in a Chinese restaurant, which for the moment will go unnamed.
May have already blown that up.
Well, we were terracotta warriors.
Jacqueline was here, so you know.
there you go. Never mind. You learn a lot about umami flavors. And this savory, what's like small amounts of savory and umami can do to a larger dish or a larger sauce or a marinade or spending like, you know, proteins and vegetables, spending time in it. Very, very potent flavors, deep flavors. One of which is very common in the area we're talking about cuisine coming from is fish sauce. And spends a lot of, like, it sneaks into a lot of the foods you enjoy from that part of the world. You rarely, probably most Americans have never smelled fish sauce by itself. If they did, they would know. It smells like a fish market in July. for one analogy to something much more raunchy I'd like to use.
To smell cunty, me. Is that what you're trying to say?
Bit cunty.
As they might say.
Like a twat that's been bandaged up and run through the grass a couple times. It is a little rough on the sinuses.
The vile smell of a desolate viscera.
Dropped a whole bottle in dry storage, I did. And it is not a pleasant smell.
Like kicking in a pig's carcass.
It honestly, like, it's such a powerful bloom of smell that occurs. It is. You have to leave. It's not.
Bloom is one of those words that it only works in one application, and every other one, it's obviously disgusting to
you. If you could see the smell rise from the floor, it would probably be such a dense smell you would not be able to see through it. It is so powerful and it lingers. So, without knowing what the marinade on these delicious meat tubes were, without a doubt, I would almost say there is fish sauce in this marinade.
Now, I know that some of that aggression is that pickled daikon, which can inspire quite a...
Vinegar has its...
It's a fast noser. And I love vinegar, but I actually do not like pickles. And so for me...
Which makes no sense.
Yeah, I know. And cucumbers were included. Love them to death. Love them when they nestle right up against that
daikon. Half kosher, after all. Half kosher, after all.
As I mentioned, actually, when Jacqueline was here, she said she was a pizza bagel because she's Italian and Jewish. And I did not quite get to say or coin it at the moment, but technically I'm a kosher jerk, as I am Caribbean and Jewish in some way, shape, or form. So in that way, fish sauce. Now, it has come up before on the cast.
Indeed. You see,
we talked just only briefly about ketchup. And ketchup originated from this very same area of the planet. It actually originated as fish sauce.
And yet another thing I have learned.
And eventually became the sauce of soy. In Japan, a man left fish in his basement in a closed container so long it fermented and turned into ketchup, which then they started to use. And technically ketchup, the reason why they call it tomato ketchup is because it is not really made with tomatoes, not until like 18-something. It was actually made with like everything but tomatoes. Onion ketchup, fish sauce ketchup, camelback ketchup.
And it was called ketchup.
And it was called ketchup, but spelled with characters which are a lot more familiar to Bon Me than it does to our American one. It's still like K-E-T, but there was some other vowels there. And so really it shows a lot of these potent umami sauces really come from this area. And the smells, of course, encourage. I remember a dealership I used to work at when I used to be involved in the motor car industry.
Remained nameless.
And this was a sandwich that, of course, me and a gentleman named Daniel, I introduced these to him. There's a little shack around the way that used to make these. I think they went under because of COVID reasons. They were rather expensive, but the bread was perfect. Massive loaf, very airy inside, almost like ciabatta. $10 per, and that's not quite street food prices.
Not at all.
That's like a real meal.
That's a meal,
if we're talking bread and ingredients. So because it was so good, it was worth the bit of poundage. However, two of those in tow, walking into a small, even full of tires or whatnot, department of other non-Vietnamese eaters, and I believe one man named Andy, who was large enough to not complain about smell, said, did somebody forget to change their fucking diaper? Because, Jesus Christ, love, like, aren't we all adults today? Like, you start looking at the cats who might be a little more geriatric and go, are you wearing a diaper, actually? Because that is a smell that humans make, this horrid,
you push a little too hard on that one.
A little fertilizer. So we enjoyed it as I laughed, daikon falling out of my mouth. Like, it's this fucking sandwich, love. You had no idea, did you? And still, light on my feet, feel great. It kind of cleanses the palate, that, a little bit of vinegar and daikon. So I welcome it, despite mayo being an alarm.
And it's funny because I am not someone who's very, I'm not a vinegar person. Where you will destroy your own mouth eating salt and vinegar chips.
Oh my, yeah. So you can't taste anything else.
I can't even smell those. And it's funny because I use vinegars. I have four different vinegars at home right now in my cupboard.
What do you have in your cup?
Balsamic.
Balsamic like a dock, right?
Mm-hmm. I have a white wine vinegar.
Classic.
I have a simple rice vinegar.
I was going to say rice has got to be in there.
Rice vinegar. And I have a seasoned rice vinegar, which is a much darker vinegar. Not balsamic dark.
No apple cider, I see.
Not currently.
You're not taking a shot every day so you live forever, as they tell me on the internet? So my credit score is going to go up just a little bit more vinegar in my tongue.
You know, I've been curious to find some recipes to use it because I would like to have some in the house.
Thai sauces, that's it. It's the only time I've really seen it outside of they marinate ham with it to loosen it up, but not really for the flavor because it cooks out. But every time, sweet and sour, whatever, Thai food, apple cider vinegar, every time.
Well, you hit it right on the nose when you talk about marinating proteins, and it is really a reason why I own so many. Now, I will cook down the balsamic with some vegetables sometimes, but if I'm baking proteins, if I'm searing off things in a pan, if I'm marinating meats, there's vinegar,
right,
of some kind.
That's why hot sauce really does so well as well. Penetrates in.
That's exactly where I was culminating to, is because and someone who had to grow into enjoying spicy foods, where, you know, our circle of friends had multiple young lads who enjoyed thoroughly their beyond spice for flavor foods. I lovingly remember sitting in our friend Steve-O's parents' kitchen and watching these fools just douse pizza with varying hot sauces.
Oh, you ordered them from the internet too. You know, the internet always supplies you with dangerous things.
It didn't even look in. I just baffled, sitting there, mouth agape, like literally sweat dripping off of the brow, not just beading, rolling off of the face, tears coming down the cheeks. What are they getting out of this? And now, as I have grown older, I now appreciate things like, oh, here's another thing you love oh so much, hot sauce on my eggs.
Eggs. It's just mayonnaise broken down. I don't want your broken down mayonnaise, but get out of here. You put it in a donut, it's
deconstructed mayonnaise
for challah bread. We already know these are great applications. But you've brought up something interesting. So, if I may, well, number one, remind me before you take your long journey, I have like a 12-year-old aged balsamic. Now, the word, I'm sure, is French, and if any French men are out there, correct me in your own time.
Please do, because if you haven't been listening to me, my pronunciations are probably not where they need to be either.
But it looks like it says demi-tasse, demi-tasse. I feel like it's demi and then T-A-S-S-E, but I might even be remembering it wrong. But it is a lovely, dark, almost Robitussin-like coating. And it was sold to me through a picture of it on ice cream. And I thought, if it's good enough to go onto the lovely ice cream, I'll give it a run, you know, on a piece of bread at least. It's the lovely.
So you're familiar very deep. With demi glace?
Absolutely.
So now, not necessarily knowing the full Monty for the demitasse, but a demi glace is a reduced all the way down to just a few, like a couple milliliters even. I mean, that's a little dramatic, but like a pot of veal stock just reduced down to nearly nothing is what makes up the heart of a demi-glace. So I'm curious to know, this is a vinegar?
This is a balsamic, yeah. Dark as the night.
Excited.
Yeah, it's got quite a bit going on. Now that brings up two things, because I do recall the first time these chips of vinegar ran into my life and I couldn't stand it. I had actually believed at the time, fourth grade, a girl named Gina, I remember. Now my
China
mum and my da, as they say, they were not snack people. Generally, I used to recycle cans so I could buy potato chips. So it was a rough time before the sterling pound. And as a result, you got to choose what you eat. I never had to be forced chips because they weren't around. So you picked it. And the white bag, hers, salt and vinegar, fish and chips. I actually do eat it with them. I buy the kettle cooked salt and vinegar. And here's the sad thing. We are ingredients men at this point in our lives. You read the ingredients, make sure they're not lying to you, and they are always lying. Yes. There is no vinegar, as you'd imagine, in any of these chips. It is usually a combination of two acidic materials.
Interesting.
It is citric acid for the lightness of it, and that's usually what you find in like Sour Patch Children. And then the more intense older brother, malic acid, which gives you a very similar. That's why if you eat a lot of salt vinegar chips, it actually burns your flavor. It's vinegar does create a feeling of burn because it's absorbing in, but this is actually just an acid. So you are chemically burning your tongue.
So you're telling me eating salt vinegar chips is self-mutilation?
It's like being circumcised, it seems, just in the mouth. And so, now certainly I do like French fries with a little bit of malt vinegar, and that took some time. It was not immediately apparent because in this very moment in grade four when Gina was available, and as a young man, I'm there begging for scraps. Please, anyone, snacks, fruit snacks, hopefully something with sugar. She says, oh, I don't like these potato chips. And I'm like, how could you not like potato chips? Now, of course, I say chips, you all know the crisps. So I grabbed her bag, bit into one and spit it out and threw away the rest. I was like, oh, no wonder you don't like these. They're bad. Like they've turned. They are yesterday's crisps.
The milk's gone bad.
I couldn't even imagine how a potato could take on such an aggressive flavor. It's like only things like broccoli and asparagus are this aggressive to humans. And lions and tigers and things. Like, why would a potato take on such a flavor? Like, these must have been bad for weeks to get to this flavor of, like, what no child likes, vinegar. Then somewhere, as my life got ever more twisted, the flavor started getting better. And literally within 2 years, it became my preferred chip. But the first time I had it, as many of you would probably feel, it was malic acid and just gone out into the trash.
I'm curious, you know, having learned that about, and not necessarily surprised in the sense it's a commercially produced crisp. So, I mean, you're not going to get anything.
It's going to go with the cheapest chalk you can buy.
Exactly. A creation. Now, I don't know where I have busted out the pot of hot oil on occasion to make fried shallots for green bean casserole. I've made homemade tortilla chips a couple times now.
Lovely.
Ooh, I know some secrets, but they were not necessarily the best, but way better than you'd expect. You make homemade chips for the first time, you're like, the bar is very low. but then you pop them out and you eat them after some salt and you're like, did I just make a La Morena chip?
Okay. I'm with you on that.
So what would an actual salt and vinegar crisp taste like then?
It's tough because, so I have actually tried before to achieve this by hand and took a bag of crisps. And as I said, I'm twisted. So here I am with a can of, if you can believe, high quality canned tuna fish in oil, slightly drained into a container, bag of kettle cooked vinegar chips. And because, again, I'm stuck under the crust of the States.
This is the closest I get to fish and chips, my friends. Mayonnaise, and he's the closest I can dumping get chips
to fish and chips. So I eat my fish and crisps.
You just lost all your English listeners.
Well, they understand how hard it is on this side of the pond, my love. And so as a result, I was like, well, I've bought the wrong crisps this one time. I've gotten plains, right? And only mental, psychotic criminals would ever buy plain potato chips. It's insane. You make plain ones at home, obviously. There's always going to be better. So here I am with a bag of the wrong chips because the blue was slightly lighter than the blue on the bag with the vinegar chips. So, you know, you shop by color. And I'm eating the fish and this is terrible. So I think, well, let me add some vinegar to the bag, right? Give it an old shake up. See if I can make me own.
And?
So, you know how we hate wet bread. So I can tell you a wet potato chip is a sad man's dream. It was brutal. And it was wetted by vinegar, which started to break it down because, you know, it's a fast mover because it gets in the cell so quickly. So every, like, because I didn't douse it. I just sprinkle and shake and maybe I'll just get a piece from time to time. And it was immediately obvious that they've never put vinegar on potato chips. It's always bullshit.
Well, it's not even necessarily always bullshit. You have to, you know, you have to think of the science behind that scenario as well. You're talking about those chips have already had almost all of their moisture removed from them. You've reintroduced moisture. So if you go
begging for it,
if you go to season something like French fries, let's say, or even, you know, chips coming out of the fryer when they're hot and you can incorporate that ingredient that time, you're looking at probably a much better outcome. Now I am speaking halfway out of my ass because I've never put vinegar on fresh chips coming out of
a fryer. I doubt you will.
Probably never would. But it's like a very basic, like, you know, kitchen tip. You know, you season your food while it's hot. And
classic wing tip, let me tell you, will ruin your wings if you season them when after they've been cooked.
Because like the flavors are locked in after that food cools down. Like, you know, you're just putting flavors on the outside of the food at that point, in my opinion, at least, when those flavors need time to marry. So I'm curious, because I know they still would not be what I would
enjoy. Oh, no, it's nothing familiar, because they use science to do that.
But you talk about, like, coming out of the rabbit hole a bit and back to the topic at hand, you talk about this pungent smell that's coming off of these sandwiches that taste like it's deceiving to your senses. When you take, if you were to run your nose along the top of this sealed sandwich, you'd be like,
it does not want to be eaten.
I'm not putting this in my mouth.
Just like those fucking chips the first time.
Oh, did you get a spoon?
Well, funny enough, this malic acid that I've run into is actually what makes warheads. It's the same multiplied by, you know, obviously a fat coating.
It's so funny. Like, you know, I've spent a lot of my adult life, after finding a passion for cooking at home, trying to use, like, you know, basing, like, create things out of their part, you know, like learn how to bake things, learn how to marinate meats and make full plates of food with vegetables and starch and all that out of real food.
Oh yeah,
but you talk about using chemicals and to create flavors.
Oh yeah, like people use dextrose. It's just like a weird sugar starch thing
product,
white powdered sugar that isn't worth nearly as much as
Scarface. I find that kind of fascinating. That, like, those two things, you know, salt and vinegar chips and warheads. That malic acid is the
same
link.
Device.
It's,
yeah,
it's very kind of cool. Like it's. Okay. Right. 'Cause it's not, and I'll never cook with malic acid.
No, hopefully you'll never have it in the hand either. It just seems to be, the additive that gets them going. And there's one thing I want to touch on additives before I let you return to your point, sir. And that is, because we were talking sort of how you get flavors, and even some flavors that you might think are real, but just like when you smell the sandwiches, ooh, it doesn't seem like it wants to be eaten, but it's just a facade. You're smelling the wrong thing in a way. It's better than it smells. And they usually sell smell as taste. We know that that's not completely true in the fermented realms. Mm. So as I was looking through some of the things on bread, because really, since the French part of this contribution on the banh mi is the bread, and as I said, that one $10 one, the bread was the only reason I would spend that. Another place just down the road from it called Benfer City, I want to say, makes like literally a $5 banh mi. It's like street prices, exactly what it should be. All the cats I know who can make it at home say it shouldn't be really more than like $5-6. However, they put like a regular hoagie roll, like not a baguette, nothing with a crisp, no airy, gluteny inside, just like a literal white roll.
Are we talking like grocery store hoagie rolls?
Like bullshit roll. Mm. Completely insulted, bleached, enriched breads. And so, although the interior is still at least, you know, a cousin of what I'm used to, the exterior was wet, the top blew out, the bottom blew out. It was literally like the exact opposite. Because you can get away with like a toast with a meatball sub in that way, a meatball sandwich, absolutely. Throw a little cheese to protect the bread and like respect it. But there's nothing to really protect this. And the mayonnaise just penetrated into gross, barely toasted bread.
Mayonnaise and penetration are not words that belong in the same sentence.
Now you can tell that's a nightmare when those start off the first two things I see. And so as I looked into breads a bit, and for those, of course, from the land of Albion, the Victorian era actually brought in some terrible breads. And I wanted to bring this to light for you, as you are cook, and you did bring me some bread today. So imagine you're back in the Victorian era, somewhere in the 18-somethings, right? It's vampire land is what I like to call it, cool style.
Powdering my wig.
Powdering your breads, apparently, too. And that's perfect. I wish I set you up for that. Because I was watching a thing, and they had three loaves. And one was like a regular prepared kind of loaf with some white flour on the outside, a little dense. Middle loaf was a middle loaf. And then one was like kind of a whole grainer, like we would say. And the ladies inform, and whoever's paying for the show, that in the Victorian era, they love profits. And as a result, they love cutting their food ingredients.
It's sawdust.
It's really this malic acid thing, right? Oh. Because if you think you could use vinegar, you could figure it out if you really cared, but you don't.
I see the line.
You use your bullshit in my chips. And so back then, you know, and this is technically well before banh mi in the 50s, they started making their breads with their additives, what they called alum. Now you can know what ingredient already, which is aluminum powder. The other one was another essential element I wish I could remember, but I might have had too much alum in my research days. So it was a powder that makes things white, and you think of sodium bicarbonate a little bit, otherwise known as baking powder. Although it is great for baking, you can use it as a cleaner, right?
Correct.
It lifts stains, it oxidizes.
Very potent cleaner, too.
Vinegar does the same. It's strange how these all marry in. Boric acid's a part of that too. And what they would do is they would put it into the bread to cut it. Because a little bit of that, some chalk in there, some sawdust, right, as you mentioned, no big deal. But the issue was the farmer would do it. And eventually the farmer didn't have to make the bread. So he sold it to the miller, right? Industrial Revolution time. The miller would also do it, right? Because he's got to make more money. And then he'd sell it to the baker. And then naturally the baker would put on his little twist of alum. So by the time you got it, it wasn't quite the innocent, I just put a little freckle in there just to make weight. No, this is like 30 to 40% non-nutritional, non-digestibles. So it was killing children en masse from constipation before the age of 3. It's aluminum powder. You're not really going to poop that out too quickly without a couple of splinters. So that was the original. And given, they even said at that point, people were like, well, yeah, we know they're always cutting food with other ingredients. And it's like, it's the mid-1800s. Jesus Christ. This is a practice. And we see it. You ever open up a candy bar? There's 46 ingredients. Alum is alive and well. The same mentality. I don't need to use sugar. High fructose things do that. I don't need to use chocolate. I got cocoa fats, right? I don't need to use vanilla. I don't even know what they have. Velenin, I think is what they call it. Some fakies. And so that was actually one of the ways they treated bread back then. And so the woman who was in question picked the whole loaf because we like brown now. We think whole foods. But she was like, but those bastards in the powdered wigs and faces, the Victorians, they preferred it white so much so that when milk would spoil, they would just add boric acid to get rid of the flavor of spoil. But not really like solve that whole bacterial issue that was going on with cow's
milk. Some of the science at work here.
And so this is why, of course, like bleached flour, although I understand maybe it's not enough bleach to hurt me today, said the baker. And it's like, right, the Victorians knew this was bullshit. You know, they were putting up wallpaper with like weird gases that would kill children. So alive and well. And that's why we are so much about, I mean, street food's great because you don't really get the capability of cutting it. It's too quick. It's too easy. So it's strange how that all comes together as we advertise for these. And that brings us to one of our final remaining thoughts and points in this. You see, as some of you out there have heard, we have worked in restaurants before for old Master Chang and his wonderful galley of mostly non-Asian workers. The question is, as we worked in an Asian fusion restaurant, technically, as it was not true to form Asian, but it had been guiloed a bit for the round eyes of us, is a man who cooks an Asian dish cooking Asian food by definition, but is it authentic as a result?
Does it matter who cooks the food? Because food itself is a vessel of, now not to get all misty-eyed on you.
Oh, let's get misty-eyed, my friend.
Of passion and of love when food is being made to be enjoyed. Now, the food we are talking about was made for profit.
Absolutely.
So kind of taking one step away from that in the sense, but your question will be answered.
No, I think you're on the right track.
If a Chinese man makes a burrito, is it Chinese food? You know, if an American makes, I was trying to think.
Pretty much anything but a hot dog, right?
Jesus Christ. It should have been a lot easier.
Because we call them French fries. We didn't even try.
Should have been an easier analogy for me to make. If it's done with love, if it's done right, if you source quality ingredients, like you put the care into the preparation and the food turns out delicious and you stay true to what the food should be, then that's what the food is.
I like that.
The person putting it together is the machine, for lack of better things, is a neutral background.
You said vessel. I like that word.
Don't I know it? But the person making the food is a neutral backdrop to the food. If the food is being prepared with love, with passion, with care, to be enjoyed by people you care about, you're a transparent thing standing behind the plate because you want everything about you is being, and your knowledge of that food and your emotions for that food going into the dish. So ethnicity almost doesn't even come into the question of it because you're enjoying different styles and forms of cuisine, but you know, it's still going to be your experience of that food you're making too. So that's where I think that bridge comes from where, you know, again, like, you know, going to the sandwich we had today, occupied Vietnam, you know, Indochina.
Indochina from the French, right?
It has these Frenchmen carrying out their baguettes, like a bag of dicks on their back.
Fresh bag of dicks.
And they you know, all those internal ingredients and flavors, you know, these ketchups that I've learned about, you know, and even like the ingredients themselves, like daikon and things that, you know, were not available, as far as I know, in France, you know, they're coming together to make this dish. And at that point, it's not one or the other. It's become something else. So but the French know this baguette, you know what I mean? The French know their mayonnaise. They make it at home. Like, there's a very French way of enjoying these foods, but at the end of the day, like, it's a very French thing, where the marinades, the proteins available, the vegetables are very Vietnamese thing in this case. And I think when I was speaking earlier about, you know, the identity of the food, and you talk about fusion cuisine, it's really important that both, like, whatever, how many kind of angles are coming in, have room to speak for themselves.
I like that. Yeah.
Because
equal, like, chairs at the flavor table.
Because that's what a fusion is. You know what I mean? Because otherwise it just becomes like a Royal Rumble of flavors, and you're not really sure what's going on. You know what I mean? It doesn't really, and that's when you know you've eaten some shite food, like at a place with a bunch of Americans trying to make sushi or something like that, where it's like, oh.
That's actually another lovely transition I wish I had predicted, because I have a couple of questions for you. Then you can let us know whether or not we have achieved food fusion.
Let's do it.
I guess, what do you call food cultural appropriation? I'm not quite sure. We'll coin it by the end of the day, I'm sure. So there was a case of a college, and they had very banh mi available in their cafeteria, it seemed, right? The mess hall. However, the students revolted. They said, this is actually racist food. I thought, interesting. Like, what did they make that banh mi out of exactly? They took pictures, and it seemed that their version of banh mi, if I recall correctly, was pulled pork, which I would say is close enough. Some swine. Coleslaw.
No.
On a basic roll.
You're talking barbecue.
And they said, here we have our, like, schools, like, pork banh mi. Would you say they have achieved fusion at that moment, sir? Or would you say that that is trash?
That's the aforementioned Royal Rumble. And that's just trying to, and that works to your analogy you made earlier about sushi being, you know, the burrito thing. Like, you can't call sushi a Japanese burrito.
Because burritos came way later. Number one.
It's point withstanding. So if you're telling me you've got a roll, pulled pork, without knowing marinade, cooking method, pork. Just pulled pork.
Long cook,
yeah. And coleslaw. What part of that
is banh mi?
Is banh mi.
And it's funny because really even the easiest part, which is the bread, is not.
No.
It's not, well, of course, even
we're talking food cafeteria, and I'm sure, as it's well known around the globe, American educational system provided meals are not we're kind of scraping
for the bin, really.
Yeah, it's scraping the bottom of the barrel. There's some really horrifying pictures you could see with one Google search on what school children are fed in this country in the public school system. So that's a prime example, I think, of a much greater issue where, and there's no racism there. It's no, just you're trying.
It's just bad news.
Really. You slapped a Ferrari badge on my Geo Prism, and you're and that's what that is. Like, misappropriation, kind of, in the sense that, like, you're.
I wouldn't even say that was cultural.
No,
that's just like, if you give me an apple and say it's a hot dog, I don't think you've insulted America. I think you've just fucked up.
You just look like an asshole. You just look stupid, and that's what that is. Well, that was a good one. I like that.
So that's the first one. There are two more.
I'm excited.
So the second one, same school. These kids were voraciously lunch-focused. And again, maybe they can intend down here in the mantle someday. Unlikely, but we'll try. So the second food that they felt might have been in question was given to them as a, I believe they said it was chicken sashimi, right? So you have something in your head which is already unfriendly. Yikes. And this is what they said they saw. They saw a piece of cooked in some way, I think roasted, chicken placed atop a hand-formed pile of rice. Sorry, I could barely get out.
We giggle at hand-formed rice, but, you know, at Michelin star sushi restaurants, those gentlemen are preparing that meal with their bare hands. And hand-formed is not necessarily insulting, but the bigger...
I think it's just funny because it was written on the placard that it was over... Because, like, oh, well, it's sashimi, so of course it's been hand-formed. So, and it's like, by which gloved lunch man or woman.
So an androgynous name for the sake of, you know, we've got Pat wearing, you know, two size too big plastic gloves, mashing together undercooked rice,
yep,
and laying a fillet of questionably cooked chicken on top of it. And we're doing chicken sashimi.
We're far from sashimi. I was like, it would have to be raw, and that is not allowed as they never serve it there. And I would think that that glove most likely is otherwise used for inseminating animals. So here you are being inseminated.
You're being inseminated.
Being inseminated through these chickens. So would you say that that would be achieved fusion, or would that be rubbish, my friend?
We're putting that in the same bin that the pork roll or whatever the fuck you wanted to call it goes in. Like, what? This is a full arm sweep across the cafeteria table for me.
So the third one, right? And now we're getting into a professional, it seems. And I prepared you for this story a bit right before you were able to seat. So let me at least get them caught up. A man in New York earlier in the pandemic year was selling banh mi. And he's a man from the Eastern Bloc. He had a very hard to pronounce last name. I will not attempt. Just trust me on that. He's a man who knows quite a bit about the Balkan state.
And continents.
And so on a post on social media, he was advertising his steal of a deal. You want some banh mi? It's going to be super cheap on Tuesdays or whatnot. And he misspells the word. You see, banh mi, it's tough. Me just saying it, you think B-A-N, B-O-N, right? Accent's a little strange. But it's B-A-N-H, right? Some people put the H before the end. Common mistake, but it's not an Arabian word, is it? As a result, somebody just said, chat. Just change it over. Flip them, right? The chair's in the wrong spot. And he felt that he was being attacked. So if, as a man with deep Irish roots, if somebody were to take a concept, a word of your island, and misspell it when they were representing it, do you feel that that would be a racist appropriating move? Is that just a mistake?
Let me at least clarify the mud in my blood, so to speak.
Have you done the testing?
I have not. And I Eric and I, my darling partner, and myself, who is Jewish, and I am generationally Irish, much more prideful in my younger days, but I've realized in my adult life I was kind of just one of those overly excitable Americans who just love putting shamrocks on everything. Irish roots for sure. Much more of just a general European mutt at the end of the day, removed enough from those roots that it's not really fair to claim. But when you talk about this situation, has this guy been to Vietnam to eat
just real banh mi?
Well, you know, but right. More of a rhetorical question in the sense that it's probably just a mistake. And he's probably very prideful since he's making this food to probably, you know, future himself. And someone comes along and he takes this spelling correction as a slight, and then it blows up in his face, I imagine.
A shameful man.
It's a tough pill to swallow for me because there's plenty of people who want to call pulled pork banh mi, and there's other people who want to call chicken and undercooked rice chicken sashimi. So regardless of knowing the quality of the product, the man just doesn't speak Vietnamese.
It's just a passer, right?
He didn't do his research. He didn't know. It's come on. I mean, I think we've all at this point in time seen multiple hilarious t-shirts from other countries where there's English phrases on them that are not spelled right.
No, the grammar's all wrong.
Oh, what is
I sort of like them better, I'll be honest with you, when that's the case.
Towing the water here because I don't know any better, so forgive my ignorance, but Keringlish or Spanglish or like, you know, any of those kind of like, you know, things where it's kind of like, it's not even just muddied water because you grew up speaking one language and went to another. Like, there's a huge cultural divide. You're just trying to like insert kind of, you know, that in there. And I think that's very much the case here for this poor bastard. I wonder if his food was good, and I suspect if his food was good, this probably wouldn't have blown up in his face quite as bad.
Right.
But I'm not judging him, and he probably just made a spelling mistake.
I agree. And honestly, folks, you know, I dug deep into the banh mi records we have here, and it's just really straightforward. I mean, surely the occupation of Indochina, I would not say was a friendly time. And you can find many conspiratorial facts and figures that you can describe, but they don't necessarily have anything to do with food. And so I'm not going to open up those worms, as that is for a much different cast of characters. However, it does seem, at the very least, and as a man with two, again, I wouldn't say that Hebrew words are easy to predict exactly where the letters go. Honestly, what makes... What's that sound, right, in a letter? Is that K? Is that C? Is there a bunch of H's with some hatred in between them? It's very difficult. So in those areas, again, and I actually mentioned to Jacqueline, as she is also a half-Jewish woman, that really, of most cultures, the Jews really take lumps just in flow. You can misspell it as long as you're not killing me in a freaking gas chamber. We're pretty good about it.
Yikes. You know, but speaking to, you know, the oddities of, you know, Yiddish and like the how do I articulate this? The spoken proper, you know, language of Hebrew, and then kind of like offset terms where we kind of slang essentially. Mm-hmm. Being married to a Jewish woman and being very close to my brother and sister-in-law, my brother-in-law Kevin and I married two Jewish sisters, and now we each have children. Promise is the only time we're going to talk about them. Is one thing we loved like so much through the pregnancies and when they were little is all these little Yiddish mommyisms of just like, you know, a buddy, your kepi. Mm-hmm. Here, they apparently tushy, like
a lot of words we use currently are that way.
Well, did you know
schmutz? I mean, right?
Nishi. Anyone who's listening is probably giggling now. The Yiddish term for a vagina, so a fishy nishi, if you will, is what those sandwiches smell like in
the
car. They
do indeed. And I say some Yiddish words look like they don't want to be spoken, much like these sandwiches smell like they don't want to be eaten.
So that ends up being kind of one of those cool things where, like, you know, there's a lot of culture behind where we got to in today to use those words when we're talking about taking care of our children or just in general. And then there's words that kind of sound like they belong in there, but aren't actually, like, you know, I had the example on the tip of my tongue, but it fell right out.
It'll fall around. And then here's the interesting thing too. Of all the restaurants you've worked in.
Quite a few.
Really, the one we worked in together served zero sandwiches. There wasn't even freaking bread in there.
Is a quesadilla a sandwich?
You know, we do talk about that later, so we'll save that. That technically... there are issues. Ooh. And a court in upstate New York has defined certain things legally.
It's on paper now.
It is on paper. At least in the state of New York.
A hot dog is a sandwich.
A hot dog is not a sandwich.
A hot dog is a sandwich.
A sandwich is not at all a hot dog, ever. And I actually saw the bloody Oscar Mayer Wiener truck 3 days ago.
Protein encased in bread.
It is not a sandwich. That's and not even so much so... that the national, again, in America, I would assume where truly the regulations for things like hot dogs would be made, the National Council.
Very generous.
For hot dogs.
There's a national council.
There's a national regulatory body for specifically hot dogs and sausage. And they said it cannot be a sandwich. And I would believe them. And they said this is why. It's a very roundabout, right? Because technically the original sandwich... was meat and bread.
I want to know why it's not a sandwich.
They gave many reasons why.
You were building to something.
They made many reasons why. And it'll kill you because it's colloquialisms. They said when, let's say, a sports player achieves a great feat and he celebrates a bit more than he should, he is not sandwiching, my friend. He is hot dogging.
Wait, that's...
that is literally on their website. I'm not kidding here. It's colloquialisms. They said, when somebody says something superlative has happened, like a car's blown up or something like that, and they say, oh man, hot dog, not, oh man, sandwich. Said, as a result, there's no bloody way that a hot dog can be considered a sandwich.
Well, I've already
because you never say sandwich when you say hot dog. And see, that is what they said.
There was already a very low pool of respect for a commission or a committee around hot dog qualifications. But if they're going to bust out hot dogging, which to me is the act of running your penis between two ass cheeks. I don't. And mind you, and was that a cock sandwich though? When that happens? Anyway, I'm going.
Right, and see, and the buns, and there's meat, but again, the hinge loaf versus a long roll. These are all discussions. I would at least report for now, as hot dogs is something we'll cover, and it's a popular topic for some, but at least for the sake of what they say.
When that sandwich conversation comes around, I would like to be on, I feel like that's
the most qualified for that one.
A multi, well, I mean,
we need a true blue.
There is so many applications to discuss, and... fuck those people. Because really?
It legit, I was surprised. Well, one, naturally, here the sandwich headquarters were always trying to change policy above the crust, right in the surface layer. And I naturally wanted to contact the American Consulate for Sandwiches, I imagine would be stationed somewhere in a governmental unit. So you see, in Britain, we have one. We have a National Sandwich Council. They take care of things. They're pro restaurants. They make sure that there's regulations. But America, it's wide open, right? You have a hot dogs clearly defined. And everything else is John Wayne, Wild West. As a result, I do put in the bid, my friends. If you ever see a Patreon, we will establish, finally, a true governing body for sandwichhood. We can determine what should and shouldn't be. We can give our ruling on the side of hot dogs. But right now, we're fighting too big a lobby to take over. We've petitioned. We've sent people to the stairs of their Capitol building, and they've toasted us away.
Many Bothans died to bring us this information.
I mean, a Rogue One sandwich would be marvelous. And I don't know if they've eaten any sandwich in a Star Wars, but I'd love to take a gander.
Oh, now you're going
to
make
what would
check.
Be a Star Wars sandwich. And certainly we have much more to explore in that. But for now, concerning Bon Me at least, we have certainly stated what we could. Now, to finish off with at least a bit of intrigue, I was looking to see, well, how many ways can you really Bon Me, right? Because one of the areas where they did consider things, and I would approve of this, somewhat appropriated, and not in a true racial way, thankfully. There's much more innocent level appropriation. It's just not knowing what the word means. Some people may make, and if you see it for sale, you'll know it's slightly misunderstood. They say like, oh, would you like, I can make you like a banh mi taco, or a banh mi bowl, or a banh mi thing, like a different thing. But see, since the word banh means baked good and mi means wheat, technically it's only talking about the bread and the sandwich. So you would have to say I have a sandwich. A pickled daikon bowl or whatever you want to change from what is, I think it might be phones, whatever you want to change and remove the bread. But you can't call it banh mi if there's no bread. You can't call it banh mi if there's no sandwich.
Correct.
However, the fillings do change. See, the filling seemed to be one of those marrying things, but funny enough, the bread is the only thing that makes it banh mi.
If you
eat a baguette in Vietnam, you know what you ask for.
Banh mi.
Exactly. It's crazy. So they truly have overstated themselves, at least in America. Certain fillings, we had a pork and a beef here, a lady in the other room eating a lovely chicken. Even a tofu is available, right? For those who may be a little more anti-animal. But, you know, they even fill them with ice cream.
An ice cream sandwich.
Right.
They put ice cream banh mi?
Yes. This is something that they do. And I've never seen that here.
You have my curiosity.
So if anyone out there listening has ever had one of these ice cream banh mis, please let me know. Send a picture to dear old Captain Noah. I would really love to see how that turns out. I've known fried ice cream. I've known ice cream sandwiches. I've known ice cream in a cone. And there's all bread considered in those applications. But I've never seen it in between like actual baked bread. Waffles are technically ironed, right? So I've never actually had it. And even
more,
and it's unleavened if it's ice cream
more
sandwiches.
Of a batter too,
and
a
even
waffle.
Even a chipwich is technically cookie batter. But I've never had it with yeasted leavened bread. So it's interesting. If a good toast is on there, I'd imagine it could be friendly. But you do have to wonder, the wetness of the bread is going to be a true factor in whether or not that's pulled off. Do they freeze the bread after they toast it? You know, is it more like a waffle cone?
If we're talking about actually eating an ice cream sandwich and a yeasted bread sandwich, then it has to be. Because through the cooking process, like again, we were talking about like the chip analogy again, a lot of the moisture is already left
the bread at that point, right?
The bread at that point. So you introduce something like ice cream.
It's madness.
It's not going to be good. Yeah. So the bread, it's very fascinating to think about like enjoying the sandwich, because I really want to try it now. Yeah. Because it's almost like the enjoyment you get out of eating mochi with the glutinous rice shell that's around ice cream. It has that delicious
texture.
Chew,
so interesting.
So
right.
Enjoying. And that's a big part of enjoying banh mi is the roll and all the flavors that are encased inside of it. I think there's some legs to that idea, and I would love to eat that.
You know, if they don't pioneer it soon, because I know it's not on the menu where we just went. Lovely place. If anybody wants to repeat the meal we've had, and believe me, their menu only opens up to more delicious flavor. You'll never know the spelling, but it's called Pho Viet Ho. It's based right outside of the Philadelphia area. There's actually a location in the city as well. I'll give them the spread because they deserve it.
Delicious.
Lovely, authentic, Vietnamese food.
Please spend your money there.
It smells as it should, and it tastes even better.
We're not being paid to say that.
It is true. It's true. They're not fans of the cast per se, but we'll see if we can ever get them on here.
Very passionate fellows about food. That's absolutely how I ended up here across the table from this fellow enjoying sandwiches.
There will be more to come in the future, sir. And I offer this to anyone out there. If you are willing to make a sandwich and bring it along, I will eat it. We can always see how you might want to elevate it, how you might want to mutate it, fuse it even, or evolve it into a stage which has not yet been reached. And if you, sir, get some ice cream and a baguette, just call me.
Final comment, though.
I'll probably melt on the whole walk, though. You know, it's so warm.
And that's what I mean. No, so let me touch on that, and then I'll have my final point as well. You have to freeze the bread, or at least chill it. Like, you know, when you do... when you're working with like doughs, like heavily buttered doughs, when you're doing like any sort of
shortbread, if you let the butter get out of it, but it's terrible.
Well, yeah, so the fat is so temperamental. So even after it's cooked, though, if you're talking about introducing more liquid, like the bread has to be frozen or at least chilled for like a certain amount of time to create the sandwich, and then it's prepared and served chilled multiple times in that process. Speaking to fusions and speaking to appropriations, like you were speaking of, the final point for me is, you know, especially about fusions and things, and you talk like when I was talking about like the emotions that go into the food, when they're done right and you spend that much emotional energy on your food, it's a homage. You know what I mean? Like you're paying respect to the two foods that you love so much to do something. So regardless of the ethnicity of the person preparing the meal, the cuisines being combined, if you show it love, it's a love song. It's poetry, to sound fucking slap me across the face lame, but that's what the food becomes. Like when you love it so much and you put it together, if it's there, it's paying respect to two things that you care about so much, you want to put them together. And when it's done right, you have centuries ago, kind of like this banh mi was created, you know what I mean? And it's matured over time, but it's still very true to probably what the original product was. It kind of transcends the sum is greater than the parts almost in a way.
Yeah, I think that would define really true fusion, where it's not to say that they are meant to go together, but they massage into a relationship and they earn the trust and work it out. And we, thankfully here at Yacht's headquarters, benefit most of the time, as long as the mayonnaise has been kept under wraps. But that is what we have for you today.
Penetration.
Ooh, close by French penetration in deep into Indochina. And as I said, that is what we have for you. So thank you for joining us today. And if anything, thank you especially for joining me, Kat.
Flattered and honored to participate.
As I said, this is a man, a professional man who knows his foods well, and you certainly will hear his voice more than once amongst these episodes here. And I look forward to being able to discuss more sandwiches with you in the future, more opinions, thoughts, feelings, and conspiracies concerning the world of food, in which we're currently under, around, and at times deep inside of. And as that's all I have for you today, I will see you next time. So till then, prepare yourselves, and I'll see you at the table.
Mayonnaise.